seated. Okay, the third case of the day, 15AP2328CR. Attorney Kahari, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
Whether children under the age of 10 can later be charged and prosecuted as adults and face adult criminal court consequences for their actions. Assuming there has been no improper delay in charging, and assuming the statute of limitations has not otherwise run in the case. To put that in proper perspective, we are talking about children that would be roughly, since I would assume the state would never charge an infant, but we're talking about children that would fall age-wise between first and third grade. At fourth grade and up, that's essentially where the juvenile justice code kicks in at age 10. So we're talking about conduct occurring between the ages of basically 5 through 9.
Why are we talking about conduct 5 through 9? Perhaps we are. But in looking at Judge Riley's concurrence in the Court of Appeals, he indicates that a problem he sees in the majority opinion is that there is no end point. He doesn't pick 5 to 9, as I recall, but he says it could be any age under the age of 9. So could you respond to why you choose 5 to 9?
Because I don't believe a prosecutor would charge an infant or a child under the age of 5 with a criminal offense.
Well, that deals with prosecutorial discretion.
That is true.
Would a prosecutor charge someone who's 7 or someone who's 9? I don't know. I'm interested in, as a matter of law, how you carve out 5 to 9.
You don't. It goes back to infancy. It would go back to day 1. If you really wanted to get technical about it, and that's what has been given us at this particular point in the Sanders opinion in the Court of Appeals. So we are talking about infancy all the way up through the age of 9 years and 365 days, basically, 65 days. So we're talking about conduct occurring at a very, very young age. And
the charge is brought after the person is an adult.
Correct.
And they're in adult court.
Correct.
But the offense is one allegedly committed by a child.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And this court in Annala, State versus Annala, decided back in 1991, almost 26 years ago, that the court that has jurisdiction at the time of the charging controls where the action is brought. So in Annala, the question was, does adult court have jurisdiction over someone, a person who would have been 15 at the time of the alleged offense? Annala was 15 and was not prosecuted until he turned 18. So Annala's attorney argued before this court that this court did not have jurisdiction, the adult court did not have jurisdiction to hear his case because his conduct occurred at a time when he could not have been waived into adult court. The waiver age at that time was 16, and the conduct itself occurred at age 15. This court, in an opinion, I believe it was authored by Justice Cece, basically held that the court where the charge is brought, later brought, and in that particular instance, Annala was 18, it was brought properly before the adult court, and he was subject to adult court penalties as a result. So that's the framework that the court was using at that time, and the court incorporated language that actually goes back much further in time than that, actually before the juvenile code as we know it was essentially created in 1977. There is the Koopman decision that was used at that time before the juvenile code was created, and there's also the LeCue decision that talked about whether or not the court at the time of charging controls versus the court that would have been in existence at the time of the offense. So up until 1991, and the Inala decision, it was unclear whether or not adult court would have the ability to punish a child or someone under the waivable age for a criminal offense and to face adult court consequences.
But that child could have been prosecuted and held accountable in juvenile court.
I'm sorry?
But that child could have been prosecuted and held accountable in juvenile court.
If the charge would have been brought at that time.
I understand that. To me, your case is a little bit different because you're talking about a claim that couldn't be prosecuted in any court. You'd just be giving care to the child as a CHIPS child in your case, right?
Correct.
So it's outside the scope of prosecution altogether.
That is the argument that I have made.
Okay.
And I believe that is the argument in this case, because there is no specific statutory authority that authorizes a prosecutor to bring a criminal charge against a child under the age of 10.
Counsel, what would have happened if this conduct was discovered when he was still under 10 and there was a CHIPS proceeding and he proceeded to receive treatment? Would that bar any prosecution for his behavior later?
Yes, it would bar.
Why?
Because this court exercised its jurisdiction, juvenile court, in that particular instance, and prosecuted that child for the way the legislature intended that child to be treated.
CHIPS proceeding is a non-criminal proceeding, correct?
It is.
All right. Do we look at this through the attachment of jeopardy lens, or is there some other analytical construct that we determine would bar subsequent prosecution?
It would be barred by the fact that there's no specific statutory authority like what would exist for a CHIPS proceeding, which would fall under 938.13 sub 12. I know of no provision in the juvenile code or the adult criminal justice code, more specifically, that would authorize a court to exercise its jurisdiction at that late date.
Well, look, can a child that's less than 10 commit a crime?
Yes.
Okay. When can you prosecute the child and where? Less
child
than 10.
Under the age of 10 can be prosecuted for a crime before they reach the age of adulthood.
Counsel?
Where?
Yeah, where do you find that?
Can be prosecuted for a crime under 10.
In CHIPS court. I'm not saying juvenile code. Court, but CHIPS court.
Okay, so if the child is under 10 and has allegedly committed a crime, then you bring them into CHIPS court. That is not a criminal court.
That is correct.
It's a child in need of
protection and services. Yes.
Right. Okay, but you don't try and prosecute him or her under 10.
Correct.
Suppose the child is between 10 and 16.
Then the child can be prosecuted in juvenile court under 938.12.
I have concerns with the term prosecuted. Let's look at what the language of the legislature chose. And then you tell me why prosecuted is the correct term, because that's the one you're using. In 938.13, jurisdiction over juveniles alleged to be in need of protection and services, that's the heading. And then it says that the court has exclusive original jurisdiction over juveniles alleged to be in need of protection or services, which can be ordered by the court if any of the following conditions exist. Now, this is the relevant provision, sub 12. The juvenile is under 10 years of age and has committed a delinquent act. Is that the language you are using to say a child can be prosecuted for a crime, or is there something else that supports your use of that language?
Well, so I can better understand your question, in this particular case, there was no CHIPS proceeding, there was no delinquency proceeding, there was a criminal charge. He was prosecuted as an adult, would have been prosecuted. The statutes do not discuss the prosecution or the commencement of a criminal action against a child under the age of 10 anywhere in 938. It just simply doesn't exist. So in this particular case, I guess I'm struggling for the right word or term to use because there isn't one in the criminal code.
Well, how about the legislative phrase, has committed a delinquent act? You see, that's in contrast with 938 sub 12, which gives jurisdiction over juveniles alleged to be delinquent. There's a difference between alleging someone to be delinquent and someone who has committed a delinquent act. There's no allegation of delinquency vis-a-vis a 938-13 CHIPS kids, let me say. CHIPS.
But yet, where does it say in 938 that a child under the age of 10 can face adult court penalties?
Oh, I'm not disagreeing okay. with you or agreeing with you. I am inquiring where you get this phrase that a child can be prosecuted for a criminal act, because I don't find it in the statutes, but perhaps I'm missing something.
Well, a child can be prosecuted for a criminal act as an adult in various...
Well, then it's an adult, not a child. Maybe
well,
a,
no,
maybe
but
it's
for instance, in adult court has original jurisdiction to adjudicate cases involving first-degree intentional homicide or battery to a prisoner. Those actions originate in adult court unless the court does essentially a reverse waiver proceeding back to juvenile court. So there are some jurisdictional loopholes, if you will, or avenues or pathways that can bring a child into adult court, a juvenile into adult court, and there are also pathways back into juvenile court.
Well, counsel, it sounds like this is a question of locus, whereas I think your argument, unless I'm wrong, is that if you're under 10, you simply can't be tried, period, right?
Correct.
Okay. So is it true, would it be your position, would you concede, that if a person is older, 10 or older, but below the waivable age, and engaged in this conduct, it was discovered, and then there was a delinquency proceeding, that that would bar any criminal conviction when the child turned 17?
Yes.
Okay. If it hadn't been discovered at that time, and was not discovered until he was 17, he could be subject to criminal sanctions, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So if that's true, if it's the simply the locus of the court that determines what penalties can be applied, why does it matter that there's not specific statutory authorization for prosecuting a child under 10?
Because that's a legislative pronouncement, not a judicial one. That's what essentially was the logic in Anala. And the court in Anala used the fact that it had jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction over the case because of the time of filing. But it's more than just that. I'm not disputing the fact that adult court had subject matter jurisdiction over Sanders at the time that he was charged. But I am disputing the fact that the court, adult court, had subject matter competency to exercise its subject matter jurisdiction because there is no known offense in the law where the state could prosecute someone for this offense as an adult.
Now, why would that be true? Because if we look at the difference between juvenile proceedings versus adult criminal proceedings, once the person is under the jurisdiction of the criminal court, you don't need to have any reference to juvenile court proceedings or definitions or offenses or anything, right?
I disagree. Otherwise, why would the court put those ages in, or excuse me, not the court, but the legislature put those ages in the statutes in the first place?
Well, I would imagine it's to determine where it gets determined. But once we have him as 17 or older, we know he's going to be dealt with in criminal court. And once we know that, we don't have to have any reference to Chapter 938, do we?
Well, we do. I believe that in this particular case, the fact that there is no statutory authority through the legislature for an adult criminal court to exercise its subject matter jurisdiction over that person, essentially there's no legislative authority for the court to exercise its competency in that case, because competency specifically requires legislative authority.
Right. So let's look at competency for prosecution of a 17-year-old for activity that occurred when he was 11. Right. So we look at the statutes describing the jurisdiction and competency of the court, and we see that, well, all we really need to know is how old is he, and what did he do. Right?
Correct.
Okay. And once he has achieved that age, we don't need to know anything about what a juvenile court would have done with him if it had been addressed at that stage. It's just he's old enough to be in criminal court, and then we just look at the act, we compare it to our criminal statutes, and proceed.
But where in the statutes has the legislature authorized that very statement? Where does it exist? It exists when we're dealing with conduct, I believe, in real time. In other words, the legislature, I don't think, ever intended us to go down this rabbit hole that we've gone down and essentially bring back offenses, largely because of the lengthy statute of limitations that exist in sexual assault cases up until the victim's 45th birthday, or homicides, which have no statute of limitations. The legislature is referring to all of these actions taking place in real time. And I think we need to harmonize those statutes so that we can understand, because that's all we have, unfortunately.
All right, so maybe you can help me out on this. So going back to the 17 versus 11 ages, where's the statute that says that the adult criminal court can prosecute an individual for what he did when he was 11?
Person who is how old?
17.
There is none.
Okay. Then why do we need one when the child did the activity when he was under 10?
Again, because we have no other statutory authority or legislative authority to act over those persons.
But if we don't have statutory authority to act over the person who was 11 when he engaged in the activity, and yet you don't dispute that we can pursue him in criminal court, right? Then why do we need
Well, you can pursue that person in criminal court based on this court's holding in Anala. That is the decision that's been used to justify prosecutions of this nature.
And were we wrong in Anala? It's okay. You can say yes.
I can say yes. I don't believe we should be in that business. That's the business of the legislature. And I think there are too many important considerations that have occurred since that issue was last decided by this court 26 years ago. Justice Abrahamson, in her concurring opinion, urged the legislature to give us more guidance on this issue to prevent inequities from occurring. And that bell has been unrung ever since that language was put into the concurring opinion in 1991.
Counsel, if you have a child who's 9, which is essentially what we are focusing on here, that child can't be prosecuted as a delinquent under Chapter 938. But the child, in fact, would have a CHIPS petition under Chapter 48, which to me, focuses on the conduct of the adult in giving care to the children, not on conduct of the child in and of himself. Is that correct or incorrect?
Well, 938.13 sub 12 authorizes the court to provide, basically, a child in need of protection and services.
But you get that out of Chapter 48.
Well, it originally came from that, yes.
Right. And the guidelines appear in Chapter 48. Right? Where in 938 does it tell you what you do with a child who's under 10 years of age when you're determining a CHIPS proceeding?
938.13 sub 12.
Okay. It says jurisdiction over juveniles alleged to be delinquent. 17-year-olds is sub 2. 938.13, you're telling me?
13 sub 12.
Well, okay. Jurisdiction over juveniles alleged to be in need of protection and services. Delinquent act before the age of 10 and has committed, the juvenile's not 10 and has committed what would be a delinquent act. Okay, so that doesn't tell you very much. I'm getting to is that I can see how you can prosecute someone as a delinquent in juvenile court. I don't see how you can prosecute someone who's 9 years old because you have to go back to Chapter 48 for the CHIPS proceedings and all the rules that apply to them, and the focus is on the parents. Are they taking care of the child? I'm just asking you, is that reasonable or not?
That's reasonable.
I just want to clear something up, Counsel. Yeah. We're talking about CHIPS a lot, but if we have a child under the age of 10 who is alleged to have committed a delinquent act, they actually do fall under Chapter 938, as you pointed us to the section, because they're alleged to have committed a delinquent act, so they are subject to a JIPS with a J petition. Chapter 48 doesn't come into play in this scenario. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, well, that's what I was asking you about exactly. Where do the JIPS conditions show up in Chapter 938?
938.13.
I read it.
I'm answering for you, Counsel. Do you want to?
You're doing a good job.
As I do come from children's court some time ago.
Yep.
938.13 sub 12 provides jurisdiction for a juvenile under the age of 10 who has committed a delinquent act. So we're not proceeding under Chapter 48.
Okay, that's what we just talked about. My concern is not that notation. I thought that you had argued, and I was basically agreeing, that you end up with a CHIPS proceeding for someone who is 7 or 8, and Justice Bradley suggests that you end up with a JIPS proceeding with a J, and I don't know where the provisions are that control the operation of a JIPS provision. So that's my question to you. If you agree with her, where are the provisions that tell us how we operate a JIPS proceeding?
Yes. I'm aware generally of that, Your Honor, and at this particular point, I know the court compared and contrasted the differences between JIPS and juvenile court in an earlier decision, and that would be, I believe that would be the DVB State, which was the decision that the Court of Appeals relied on in this case. DVB State dealt with a situation somewhat similar to this, where we had what would be considered JIPS, or at that time CHIPS era conduct, later being charged in juvenile court. That was essentially DVB State. DVB State says that because of the many similarities between CHIPS outcomes and or JIPS outcomes and juvenile court, that it was not to a level where equal protection or due process was challenged or challengeable. So the Court of Appeals in that particular case, and that was the main case I believe that the Court of Appeals relied on in this case, held that, okay, this was JIPS or CHIPS era conduct. It can be prosecuted at the adult level without engaging in any of the analysis that the court did in DVD State, where it compared and contrasted the differences between CHIPS or JIPS court, the outcomes, versus juvenile court outcomes. And in that particular case, the court found that there were more similarities than differences and allowed the court to proceed with the child under the age of 10 as a juvenile, even though the conduct preceded it by a matter of a week.
Was that child under the age of 10? Wasn't that child 11? And the statute was different at the time?
It was.
12?
Yeah. It was.
In fact, the statute in that case is 1981. I want to fast forward to the juvenile justice reform that happened in the mid-1990s, which forms the basis of our legislation today.
Correct.
Chapter 938. Now, 938 covers a variety of areas, and including waiver. Is there any provision in 938 for waiver from a child under the age of 10 to either juvenile or adult court?
No.
Is there any provision in 938 for waiver of a juvenile, I'm going to say 10 to 17 by definition of juvenile, into adult court? Do you understand my question?
I do. And Justice Bradley, my light is on.
You can answer the question,
question,
yes, please.
There are pathways for a juvenile over the age of 10 to be waived into adult court.
And indeed, there's reverse waiver provisions in 938 also.
Correct.
Do you have any reverse waiver provisions for children under the age of 10 exist in 938?
No.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Deputy Solicitor General Kevin Leroy on behalf of Wisconsin. The core legal issue here is whether the adult criminal court, the court of criminal jurisdiction, had competency to adjudicate all of the charges that were brought against Mr. Sanders. That is a separate and a distinct inquiry from the power of a prosecutor to bring criminal charges in the first instance, and it is a separate and distinct inquiry from the capacity of juveniles or the capacity of adolescents as they stand at the time they commit conduct to have formulate the criminal intent necessary to find a violation of the criminal law.
Is that the precise question, what did the legislature intend vis-a-vis this?
Yes, that's exactly right. The precise question is, what did the legislature do when they set up what I've described as Wisconsin's three-court framework? But even beyond that, though, this is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and I submit that the court should reject this claim for three reasons. First, counsel declining to challenge the court's competency was not deficient performance because the defendant's age at the time the state files charges has always determined which court has competency over those charges.
Do you think the law is well settled in that regard?
Yes, I do think it's well settled. And so since Sanders was an adult at the time the state filed the charges here, the court of criminal jurisdiction and not the courts for juveniles was the proper court, so he was not ineffective in that regard. But second, as I said, the law is well settled, so if the court would wish to repudiate the settled area of the law, the age at filing rule, which my friend has asked this court to do, Sanders' counsel was not required to raise a long-shot argument to long-settled law in order to provide the constitutional minimum of effective assistance. And then third, even if the court disagrees with everything I've just said, Sanders cannot show prejudice. So even if he could show his counsel performed efficiently, his claim would fail. The court would have to affirm the Court of Appeals. So as I said, this is a question of statutory interpretation. We have three statutes that are relevant. First is the statute for the court for juveniles under 10, and that says the court has exclusive jurisdiction over a juvenile if the juvenile is under 10 years of age and has committed a delinquent act. And that's 938.13.12. That's the JIPS statute.
It has exclusive jurisdiction to do what?
It's exclusive jurisdiction over a juvenile alleged to be in need of protection or services. And then the specific heading that we fall in here is he is in need of a protection or services, the juvenile under 10, because the state has alleged he has committed a delinquent act.
That requires intent.
I'm sorry?
That requires intent, right? Doesn't the act of the
Oh, yes,
that's requires intent.
But that's just the question of whether he has or has not violated the criminal law. So delinquency, a delinquent act is a violation of any state or federal criminal law by an individual under 18 or under 17, rather.
I get that, but the law that you're saying he violated required intent, and if you have a crime that doesn't require intent, and there are some that don't, okay, I can understand the argument, and I guess my concern is, should we look at this differently because the crime with which he was charged required intent? Intent for what? Sexual gratification or some such thing, correct?
Yes, that's correct, but that was the intent element of the crime. My position is that the substantive elements of the crime is a distinct inquiry from whether or not a court has competency to adjudicate the charge.
And you make that distinction because we're here on ineffective assistance rather than in the get-go from the beginning, if this had been raised below.
No, that's not correct. I make that distinction because he's challenging the competency of the court. He's challenging the power of the court to invoke its subject matter jurisdiction to adjudicate the charge, to adjudicate it. Now, whether or not he's guilty of or liable or has violated the law, the charge, that's a separate inquiry that we talk about, the elements we talk about.
See, what's bothering me here is that you have a charge on someone who is 9 years old. Say he's 5 years old. You could have the same charge for the same conduct, right?
So I would say the charge is against an 18-year-old.
Okay. No, I understand that, but just bear with me a little bit.
Certainly.
Okay. If you could have prosecuted this at the moment that it happened, it would have been against a 9-year-old, correct? And the charge requires intent. And my concern is, I understand that the law is well settled. If you have someone that's 12 and you prosecute him as an adult at 18, I get that. But you have someone here that's so young, my concern is, could you really prosecute someone that young because of the kind of crime you're charging? And the real pause I would have was saying that someone 9 years old could really form the intent to have sexual gratification by what he was doing.
So a couple of points, and I hope this clears up the confusion.
Okay.
Confusion here. The charge here is against an 18-year-old for conduct he committed when he was 9. Now, had the state found out this criminal conduct, this misconduct, when the defendant was 9,
right.
It would not be a criminal prosecution in
right.
the adult criminal court. It would be a GIPS proceeding,
okay.
which is focusing on the juvenile, ordering types of remedies that focus on the parent's relationship to the child, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But
would you have to prove the same elements in a GIPS proceeding as you do in a criminal proceeding for the same conduct?
So I think you would have to prove the same elements in order to trigger the court's ability to order the state intervention into the juvenile's life, the 9-year-old's life. And so
if you could never prove intent, you could never get help for the juvenile?
In a GIPS proceeding, if you could not find an allegation, if you cannot prove an allegation of a violation of the criminal law, you would not be able to order interventions for that reason. Now, there are others.
Could have brought a CHIPS at the same time you brought the CHIPS,
yes, exactly.
right?
This is completely separate from CHIPS. That's Chapter 48.
Right.
That defines, this is actually interesting. So CHIPS uses the term juvenile
when
it's under 18 or 17.
Yep.
CHIPS uses the term child, and they define it as under 18. So it's just even completely separate terminology here. We are in juvenile justice code land. We are not in...
But if this boy were prosecuted at 9 for this kind of a crime, you would have had to proceed. I understand that you can use a statute for a GIPS, but since you have to prove intent of a 9-year-old for sexual gratification, you could have brought a CHIPS proceeding together or separately.
Yes, to be clear, I have not briefed the CHIPS.
No, and I get that. It's just that I'm concerned about how the statutes fit together.
And I have a passing knowledge of it. So there are other types of things. So the juvenile has been neglected, the juvenile is in need of danger, et cetera.
Sure.
One could imagine the drafting of a CHIPS petition that gets at this kind of conduct here, and then the court can have services, right? So the state would be able to meet that burden.
Okay.
CHIPS.
Good. Thank you very much.
Counsel, what provisions under 938 specifically address, either by procedure or substance, a child under the age of 10.
So 938.1312.
Other than that, that's the only thing we've talked about. Certainly. Is there any other provision in 938 that deals with a child under the age of 10?
So there are multiple headings under 938.13 and then 12. That's just one heading for GIPS proceedings. There are others for a child who is delinquent, who has committed other types of, who is truant from school. There are other types of headings there that would authorize the state to bring a GIPS petition and then order services for the child if it proves it. And then beyond that, there's the remedies portion, which I don't have the statute right in front of me. It's in my brief, that talks about the type of remedies that the juvenile court can order, and it calibrates the remedies, whether it is a delinquency petition or whether it is a GIPS proceeding. So that reflects a recognition of the differences there. So the main one, the far and away the main one, is that you cannot put someone under 10 in a juvenile delinquency facility.
My concern in part deals with the two things. The legislative intent of 938, as set forth in 938.01 sub 2, does not seem to fit with a child under the age of 10. And also, the second part of my concern, and I'd like you to address both of those. I'll stay with the first part of my concern. For instance, sub B, to hold each juvenile offender directly accountable for his or her acts. Do you think that applies to a child under the age of 10?
If the state is alleging that the juvenile offender under 938 has invoked the competency of the juvenile court under 938.1312, and the allegation is the 9-year-old has violated the criminal law, that is, has committed a delinquent act, then yes, it does. We still have to prove that they violated the criminal law, the substance of the delinquent act.
There is no provision, well, then I look at 9C, to provide an individualized assessment of each alleged and adjudicated delinquent juvenile. A child under the age of 10 is not an alleged or adjudicated delinquent juvenile.
So,
and that's the purpose. I mean, a lot of these purposes just don't fit for the child under the age of 10.
So, a couple of points. The Act clearly defines juvenile to include any children under 17 when we're talking about delinquency, or 18 when we're just talking generally. So that clearly includes children, juveniles, who are under 10. And then we have this particular special court competency granting provision that says for juveniles under 10, you can allege that they are delinquent, but it looks different when it's juveniles 10 and over. And it's different because we call it a juvenile in need of protection or services, and we calibrate the type of remedies that are available. And now the important point is that this is a completely separate inquiry than the substance of the alleged offense. So, for example, if we allege sexual assault against a 9-year-old, you would still have to prove that the 9-year-old formed the requisite intent, the same intent that we hold adults to. What we're saying is the 9-year-old has committed an adult act, and we are going to hold them liable for that. And the way we're going to do that is by ordering protection and services. But now, so that's a separate question, though, of the question that's presented here, baked into an ineffective assistance claim, is did the court, the adult criminal court, the court of criminal jurisdiction, have competency over Mr. Sanders, who we started the trial, I believe, when he was 19. We alleged he violated the criminal law when he was 9, all the way through when he was 18. That was cut into four different counts. Count 1 is the only count that related to his 9-year-old conduct. He was acquitted on count 1. So that's the only issue here, is whether, one, it was deficient performance for Mr. Sanders' attorney to fail to challenge competency on count 1, and then, two, whether that failure, if he can prove that, caused him prejudice, despite the fact that he was acquitted on count 1.
Counsel, before you go too far on the ineffective assistance part of your argument, Could you help me with one thing here? So let's say this conduct was discovered when the child was 11, took place before he was 10, and so there was a proceeding, juvenile in need of protection or services. If that proceeding goes to conclusion, does that bar a prosecution for that conduct once he turns 17?
It does because of Wisconsin Statute 938.35 sub 1M, I believe. So that's a statutory bar to future criminal prosecution. There's also a provision that says jeopardy attaches, and there's no indication about it attaches when the first witness is sworn. There's no indication of whether that is calibrated by age. However, you don't have the right to a jury trial in a GIPS proceeding, so perhaps jeopardy wouldn't attach. But that is, a separate issue. I'm not here to defend whether the legislature could repeal that. But yes, so there's a statutory bar. You cannot prosecute the same individual in a juvenile delinquency petition and then subsequently in a criminal prosecution once they
okay. And the consequences of a delinquency proceeding when they're found in need of protection or services, those consequences are significantly different from criminal sanctions, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. So the part that I have some difficulty wrapping my mind around is this. The consequences change dramatically depending upon when the conduct is discovered, rather than any difference whatsoever in the conduct. Why is that?
The reason why is because, and this relates to really the competency framework. A delinquency action is an allegation that the child, the juvenile, has violated the criminal law. That is the exact, so the conduct that is going on from the state's perspective, from the legislature's perspective, just drafting the statute, is the exact same type of conduct that occurs when an adult violates the criminal law. So that's how they draft the substantive criminal statutes. The way that we account for children or for juveniles is by the creation of these courts. And so we say, if we have an allegation that you committed what would have been adult criminal conduct as a juvenile, we are going to shield you from the full consequences of that by allowing you to go, by adjudicating you through the juvenile courts. Now,
right, but only if the conduct is discovered before he turns 17.
Yes. And so the broader point is that, as this court has said, I believe in Anala and at least Koopman, the juvenile courts are creatures, the competency for the juvenile court, that is a creature of the legislature. The legislature could remove them tomorrow if they wish, aside from, pending petitions. Put that aside. Going forward in the future and say, we are going to try any individual, any person in the adult criminal court, or that's why the statutes phrase it as the court of criminal jurisdiction. Now, if they did that, one, I think that would be unjust as a matter of public policy, but it would not be unconstitutional. If they did do that, then we would have full constitutional protections for criminal proceedings against juveniles. So, for example, they would be required to have an attorney. They'd be required to have a jury trial if they so wish. They'd be required to have guilt adjudicated beyond reasonable doubt. Those are not the same types of things that happen in GIPS proceedings, and some of those types of things don't happen in juvenile delinquency proceedings. So that was a long answer.
It's almost, I think, to what I need to understand. So would this be a fair characterization of the state's position? The individual conducts this kind of activity, regardless of their age, is responsible for the full consequences of that activity. However, the legislature, as a matter of grace, has decided that if this is discovered while you are yet young, that we will deal with you differently, right?
Yes, that is the position. My only bracket is that's about criminal liability. Sentencing is another completely separate issue that is not at issue here. So this court has said that a court must consider the characteristics of a juvenile, the threat to society of the characteristics of the defendant who has been found guilty, the threat of the defendant to society, and the level of the severity of harm and the retributive rationale. And so if you had someone who is 9 years old who is found after a jury trial, hypothetically depositing, to be fully guilty of what one would consider adult criminal behavior, I think it would be an abuse of discretion for the court to say, I am not going to consider at all, not even going to address how old you are. So that's at the sentencing end. So the fundamental point here is that Wisconsin law does not deal with what are certainly valid policy issues with respect to juveniles and current behavior. It does not really deal with that fully in the competency statutes. The competency statutes do one specific thing, and that is define when the specific courts that the legislature has, the competency they've created, when those courts have power to adjudicate juveniles, juveniles under 10, juveniles over 10, and then adults.
Counsel, sometimes I smile because I think of words. And I want to get to what seems to me to be an absurd result of the argument advanced. And you tell me why it's not absurd. I think it is absurd, I'm positing, that the legislature would intend that a 7-year-old who plays doctor, euphemistically, with a 4-year-old cousin by behind the house in the bush, touching the vaginal area. It seems absurd to me that the legislature could say, 20 years later, that that person can be prosecuted for that 7-year age behavior. To me, that's an absurd result. Tell me why that's not absurd. What am I missing in finding that the legislature intended that? I still don't know where the legislature says they intend that, but that's the argument, and you're talking about the cases. But tell me why that result is an absurd.
Sure.
I just find it hard to think that the legislature intended that.
So I'll take your question in pieces. So the first part, you do not have to think that that is not absurd in order to agree with us. In fact, I think that is absurd. However, the legislature has dealt with that issue in a way that is different than the competency framework. And the way it has dealt with that is by defining as an element of the criminal offense that you have to have the intent to commit a sexual misconduct in a way that is inconsistent with what they have said is juvenile behavior, as this court has said, in a way that is inconsistent with childhood behavior.
And do you agree that the Court of Appeals opinion can be interpreted as the concurring opinion of Judge Riley states that there is no limitation backward under the age of 10 for its legal conclusion?
So I do not agree that the Court of Appeals opinion has held that in any and all circumstances, a prosecutor, consistent with Wisconsin law, can bring a charge, a valid charge, without committing ethical misconduct against a 7-year-old.
Do you think a charge can ever be brought against a 7-year-old for touching the vaginal area of a 4-year-old cousin?
Yes.
You think a charge can be?
If.
How about a 6-year-old?
Yes.
Can a charge be brought against a person years later for when they were 6 and touched the vaginal area of a cousin?
So aside from statute of limitations problems,
the 45-year statute
of
limitations.
The evidence is sufficient to convict.
So you think this is what the legislature intended?
Yeah.
Do you think there ever can be evidence sufficient to show that a 6-year-old has the mens rea to act with intent to become sexually aroused or gratified or to sexually degrade or humiliate?
No, I don't think that. However, if circumstances somehow arose in which that would occur, then a prosecutor should be able to vindicate the harm done to the victim. And so that's the framework that the legislature has created. And this court has recognized. Wisconsin law recognizes no boundary on the bottom end for criminal prosecution. So the Wisconsin law does not have the type of presumption that is mentioned by my friend on the other side of the most vague treatise. We do not have a presumption of criminal incapacity. That does not mean in every individual case that any person who just goes through the actions that would qualify as one of the elements can be held criminally liable. In every single case, the prosecutor has to show criminal intent. Every single case, whether a criminal case, and a gyps case, and a juvenile delinquency case. And so, another important thing is this is not just in the realm of the prosecutor. So, of course, the prosecutor has the authority to, has the raw power to bring charges. But he has to go forward through the probable cause barrier in front of a court. So if you had a situation where a rogue prosecutor, comes to the court and says, I have found someone who is now aged 50. When he was 7, he committed this misconduct against someone who is now herself 44 to the statute of limitations. I would think that the court should throw that out, unless you have incredibly powerful evidence at the front end to get over the probable cause barrier that shows that he had the ability to form the criminal intent for the substantive elements. Now, that is all aside from what the issue is here. The issue is, what did the legislature say in the competency statutes, whether or not the courts had competency to adjudicate the charge, whatever that charge is, competency to adjudicate the charge against Mr. Sanders. And if you look at the statutes, it's just a question of statutory interpretation. It's just a question of what does Kalal say. The statutes say that, in fact, the adult criminal court, the court of criminal jurisdiction, had competency to adjudicate the charge against Mr. Sanders because at the time the state filed the charges, Mr. Sanders was over 17.
What statute says that?
The statute that says that is the statute is 75303, and it says
75303.
So we cited it in our brief. I don't think Mr. Sanders actually cited it. And it says the court of criminal the circuit court has jurisdiction to hear and determine all. I'm omitting irrelevant language. To hear and determine all criminal actions and proceedings, unless exclusive jurisdiction is given to some other court. So we have to do two things. One, is this a criminal action or proceeding? Yes, we have alleged that Mr. Sanders violated the criminal law multiple times. And then the second question is, is the unless clause met? The second question is the unless clause met in 75303? It says, unless exclusive jurisdiction is given to some other court. Well, if we look at the two statutes for the competencies of the juvenile courts, that does give exclusive jurisdiction to a court, but not on the circumstances here. 938.13 sub 12, which we've talked about, says the court will have exclusive jurisdiction over a juvenile if the juvenile is under 10 years of age and has committed a delinquent act. And the statute for the court for juveniles age 10 and up, 938.12 sub 1, it says the court has exclusive jurisdiction over any juvenile 10 years of age or older who is alleged to be delinquent. So those two statutes, the statutes for the courts for juveniles, they use the present tense language. And they also say the word, the juvenile. So those are two independent reasons that show that the individual who is on the receiving end of the allegation of the petition or the criminal charge has to be a juvenile presently in order for those two courts to have competency to adjudicate the charges against him. If he does not fall into those two courts, then you go into the general rule for the court of criminal jurisdiction, and he must have, that court must have competency over him.
Do you know when this matter was tried, do you know if the argument was made in front of the jury that the prosecution had to prove what would have been his intent when he was 9? He was acquitted of this charge, so I mean, maybe we're talking about something that the jury focused on, too.
Yeah, so the jury had all of the valid elements in front of them as jury instructions. I don't know if the Mr. Sanders' attorney specifically said, you must show intent in so plain of words, but he did allude. He said, I think something to the effect of, how can we know, that kind of argument. Mm-hmm. And then, to the extent this is probative, the note from the jurors, it said, how can we discover the intent of a 9-year-old?
Okay, and so they were concerned about the same thing we're talking about.
And then the response from the court was just this is approved by both sides, was just the jury instruction for intent, whatever has been acceptable to this court.
Yeah. Counsel, I'd like you to tell me what you think if I wrote for the court on this basis. The question presented for the court is, does counsel render ineffective assistance of counsel by failing to object to the circuit court's competency to hear a charge against an adult defendant when the charge relates to the defendant's misconduct as a 9-year-old? I think that's the issue here.
I have one quibble.
Yep.
I don't think it was a failure.
Pardon me?
I don't think it was a failure. I think it was a strategic choice to not bring up this issue.
Okay, but it didn't object. Okay.
That's correct. He chose not to object.
And then suppose I would write that defense counsel didn't render ineffective assistance of counsel because it's the defendant's age at the time of charging, not at the time of the commission of the crime, that controls what court hears the case. And the defendant loses because the issue is far from settled.
The second part I disagree with, and I disagree...
Which is the second part?
The settling. I think it is settled. I think
that What's settled?
I think the issue, what I have called the age at filing rule, that the competencies of the courts are established by looking at the age of the defendant at the time the state files charges. I think that is settled. It is settled because of the plain language of the three statutes that we've been discussing, and it's settled because of ANALA. Now, ANALA interpreted the statute for the court for juveniles at that time, I believe it was over 12. I could be wrong on that. But that statute is materially identical to the statute for the GIPS statute. And so this court must have the same statutory interpretation for that statute as well. So since the juvenile court for juveniles over 10 uses the age of filing rule, the juvenile court for juveniles under 10 must use that same rule because of the materially identical language. So it is settled.
Where in your brief you mentioned in response to me what statute authorizes, because I still have questions about if the legislature really intended the six-year-old that we were discussing to be able to be charged subsequently. And you referenced 75303. Where is that argument developed in your brief at all, that that's the statute that you're relying on, that we should rely on?
Sure. So in the statement section, I don't have the page numbers. So in the statement section, we talk about that statute. And now, I think I might quibble with the framing of the question. The question that we have answered for this court in the state's favor is, did the court have competency? That is a different question than, does the prosecutor have the power to bring the charge?
Oh, I understand that. I understand that. But you are... relying on 75303, I don't recall reading 75303 anywhere where there was a developed argument. I know that you referenced the statute, but you don't argue it. No one else in all of this stuff talks about 75303, and now we're here in oral argument, and that's the statute that I should look to answer that this is what the legislature intended?
So throughout our brief, we have argued that 75303 is the court of general jurisdiction that has jurisdiction to hear all criminal charges.
Right.
Unless the child falls within the exclusive jurisdiction of the courts for juveniles. And so then we argued quite clearly that this person here, this defendant, does not fall within the competency for the juvenile courts. So therefore, he necessarily falls within 75303. So that's our argument. I apologize, I don't have specific pages out here.
That's okay.
And so before I sit down, I'd like to just touch on the prejudice component. So the court could disagree with everything I've just said, and they would still have to affirm for the state. And the reason why is because this is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And so in addition to a deficient performance, he must show prejudice. He was acquitted of count one. So the only prejudice that my friend can show is if count one, because it was erroneously considered, allowed the introduction of evidence that would not otherwise have been admitted. I see my red light is on, if I could just finish.
Very briefly.
So all of the evidence that was in is either directly relevant, falls under the other acts rule, or if you even put it aside, there's sufficient, more than sufficient evidence to convict anyway.
Thank you.
Police court. The Chief Justice Rogensack, you mentioned where in the juvenile code is there any reference to the possible outcomes of a GIPS proceeding? I did find it, 938.345.
Thank you very much.
And counsel, on that note, the dispositions available, as counsel on the other side, I believe, has acknowledged, are pretty much the same as they are under the delinquency code, except, to be brief, you can't lock the child up. Is that accurate?
Correct. And that's essentially what the DV case was all about, a comparing and a contrasting of those two systems. But the court in DV was not asked to decide and compare and contrast the CHIPS or GIPS code, if you will, and the adult criminal code that would come into play if the child later became an adult by the time he or she was charged.
You're not challenging the law, the rule, that a person who committed a delinquent act under the age of 17 can be charged as an adult in criminal court, correct?
Correct.
So why is it any different for a child under the age of 10 who is subject to GIPS jurisdiction and the same dispositions as a juvenile delinquent except for lockup?
Because the legislature set an age at 10 where the juvenile code would come into play.
Chapter 938 does come into play for children under the age of 10 who have committed a delinquent act. They cannot be found to be juvenile delinquents. They are found to be juveniles in need of protection or services, but they still come under Chapter 938.
They do, but they are, I think, a different subsection of that same chapter. They're treated differently, and
they
there are very different consequences.
But again, all the dispositions that are available to the children's court judge with respect to a juvenile delinquent are available for a GIPS child except locking the child up.
Correct.
That's the only difference. You agree, right?
I would agree.
Okay, thank you.
And I would also go back to the argument about, well, he was acquitted. Sanders was acquitted on count one. Just because he was acquitted on count one doesn't mean that the jury found him innocent of that conduct. That is simply a case where the state was not able to meet their burden of proof. By failing to object to the introduction of all of the pre-age 10 conduct in the first place, Sanders was not given, I think, an opportunity, based on the way that counsel chose to play this issue in front of the jury. And I don't believe it was a matter of strategy. I think counsel did not recognize that this was an issue until it was too late to deal with it. This issue first arose after the state had already rested its case. The jury had already heard all of this pre-age 10 conduct come in through various sources. By the time that counsel got around to raising this, and I think misframing the issue as one of a burden of proof issue, as opposed to one involving the competency of the court to exercise its subject matter jurisdiction. So by waiting that long into the game to raise the issue in the first place, all of this earlier conduct came in, and the court never had a chance to consider whether or not it was even admissible at that point, because it had already come in. And as we've argued in our brief, I don't believe that evidence would have been admissible in this case. And there's some, the McGowan decision talks about the relevancy and the danger that might envelop a defendant if that conduct, the pre-age 10 conduct, or a conduct that's committed at a very, very early age, I think McGowan was 10, or at least the conduct that the state was attempting to introduce in that particular case was at a time when McGowan would have been 10.
Counsel, you're not making any equal protection or due process violation arguments, are you?
Well, I am, in the sense that if DV, the state, up to this point, in my opinion, is the only court that attempted to explain the fundamental differences between these systems and the fact that, all right, we'll allow it to happen within the facts of DV, the state, because the systems are similar. But in this particular case, we are faced with conduct occurring under the age of 10 that would have been GIPS or CHIPS era conduct versus adult court criminal conduct, which is radically different. And that's why I felt all of the brain science arguments that had been brought before the United States Supreme Court in Roper and are so critical in understanding this issue, because we're trying to punish a child who has not formed, fully formed with adult court consequences for something that they did before they had the mens rea or a fully developed brain.
Thank you.
I see my time is up.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for good arguments. This is a tough case. lots to think about. The briefs were very helpful, as were the oral arguments. So thank you both. We are going to adjourn, and we'll meet again in closed conference at 3:10. We will adjourn. Thank you.